So this is the eve of our 7-day Rohatsu Sesshin. This is an ancient Zen tradition of celebrating Buddha's awakening the first week of December. And it just so happens that the days line up exactly this year. So on this eve, all over Japan, and probably America too, people are anticipating 7 days of sitting starting December 1st through December 7th, celebrating Buddha's awakening on December 8th. And another thing that we'll have on December, on the end of Sesshin, next Wednesday evening, is a ceremony called the Shuso Dharma Inquiry Ceremony. And everyone's welcome to attend. We have the Shuso is the head student, Nanette Monshin Tennen. This practice period has been sitting diligently, and this will be a culminating ceremony for her. She'll bring up an old story and we'll ask her questions and she'll respond. And there's a lesser known ancient tradition in our school of Soto Zen, in Japan anyway, of the night before this Shuso Dharma Inquiry Ceremony, the abbot or teacher at a temple will bring up the story that will be commented on the next day. So I don't know if this has ever happened in America, but it will tonight. Even though this is not quite the night before, it's the Wednesday night before. So I know some people who are here tonight will be here next Wednesday, probably in between also. But this is the story that I think the Shuso will bring up about Bodhidharma. So this will prime the pumps at that time and prime the pumps tonight. Also, I think it's a wonderful story to begin just embarking on this retreat for those who are doing it. It's a story about sitting meditation and the mind of Zen meditation. Now we have two main renditions of this story about Bodhidharma, who's the Chinese Zen founder, brought Zen from India to China in the 6th century. Often we, the Shuso will read the story from the Blue Cliff Record, which is a collection of these old Zen stories. It's the first case out of 100 cases or 100 Zen stories in the Blue Cliff Record. It's the first one. And the same story, or basically the same story, is the second case, or the second story in what we call the Book of Serenity, another collection of 100 Zen stories. So for whatever reason, our San Francisco Zen Center tradition, the Shuso usually reads the Blue Cliff Record version, which is a little bit longer. My guess is that the reason for this is that that translation was around many more years than the Book of Serenity. So when the ceremony started in the late 60s, this book was not yet translated. But usually in Soto Zen, this version and the verse is sometimes read to of the story in the Book of Serenity. So this Shuso can pick either one. The Blue Cliff Record is kind of nice because it's got a little extra addition about this minister juror But tonight I'll bring up the Book of Serenity version. And just speculation on how these things are set up. This is just a little bit about these Zen koan collections. Koans are these cases or stories. Now, the Blue Cliff Record begins with a story about Bodhidharma. This Book of Serenity, it's the second case. And I'll just briefly read the first case, the first koan, the first story, because in a way it follows after this. Also, I might mention that the Blue Cliff Record is usually associated with Rinzai Zen school, collected by a Rinzai Zen teacher and usually spoken of and commented on in the Rinzai Zen tradition. And this Book of Serenity is collected by a Soto Zen teacher in ancient China and commented on and more in Soto Zen. So both the choosing of these stories and the arrangement of the stories and the commentaries and verses on the stories could be studied through the lens of these two different approaches to Zen, this Rinzai and Soto approach. So since this one is more aligned with our particular Soto tradition, I think it makes sense to me that this other case comes before. So first, this is the first story in the Book of Serenity called The World Honored One Ascends the Seat. The story goes like this. One day, the World Honored One, which is an epithet for the Buddha, one of the Buddha's many names is the World Honored One, the Bhagavan. One day, the World Honored One ascended the seat, like the teaching seat. Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of great wisdom, we have enshrined on our altar here on a lion, he struck the gavel and said, clearly observe the Dharma of the King of Dharmas. The Dharma of the King of Dharma is thus. And at that point, the World Honored One got down from the seat. And that's the end of the story. Now, some of these Zen koans are very dramatic, and there's lots of dialogue back and forth between these Chinese Zen ancestors. Sometimes there's shouting and hitting and throwing things. But this is a very simple story. And I think it's because this is the flavor of Soto Zen, our tradition. It's very simple and plain at its heart. So one day, you know, like this day, like a particular day, the World Honored One, the Buddha, ascended the teaching seat, getting ready to speak, but he didn't say anything. He sat there in Zazen on the seat. And Manjushri, who's the expounder of perfect wisdom, everything he says is totally in accord with the truth. He made this announcement, clearly observe the Buddha sitting on the seat. Clearly observe the Dharma of the King of Dharma, the teaching of the teaching king, the Buddha. The teaching of the King of all teaching is thus. Thus. He maybe even gestured to the Buddha on the seat. The Dharma of the King of Dharma is thus. Buddha hadn't said a word yet, but that was all Manjushri had to say. Keep it simple. The Buddha just sitting zazen on the seat is the Dharma of the King of Dharma being fully and completely expressed. And then the Buddha got down from the seat and left. Like that was the end of his Dharma talk. But we might also say that the reason he got down from the seat, that we could say that the Buddha disappeared, is because Manjushri actually, even though he didn't say very much, he maybe said a little too much. Even to say that the Buddha's complete teaching is thus, we might say, well, we'd like a lot more than that. We'd like some more instruction than just the Buddha's teaching is thus. But the Buddha maybe actually felt that that was already saying too much, so he left. Buddha is being manifested before us every moment. Buddha is thus. But if we put any words on it, even saying the Dharma, the Buddha's Dharma is thus, the Buddha can't stand being labeled, even in that kind of way. So the Buddha disappears. So that's the first of 100 stories that get more and more elaborate, or sometimes not. But I think it's quite beautiful that the expressing the style of what we call Soto Zen begins with just this simple zazen, expression of zazen, sitting still, thus. And even to call it thus is enough that the Buddha disappears. So the verse, the beautiful verse celebrating this story says, the unique breeze of reality, do you see? The truth wind, the wind of truth, the unique breeze of reality, do you see? Clearly observe. Continuously creation runs her loom and shuttle, weaving the ancient brocade, incorporating the forms of spring, but nothing can be done about Manjushri's leaking. Always creation is running her loom and shuttle, weaving the ancient brocade of thusness, incorporating the forms of spring when it's spring. But nothing can be done about Manjushri's leaking. So it's a little critical. Manjushri leaked. It's like we have WikiLeaks. This is a Manjushri leak. He leaked too much by just saying thus. And nothing can be done about it. Like, it's too late, the Buddha's gone. But it couldn't be otherwise. If Manjushri didn't leak and if we never talked about the Dharma, we wouldn't have 100 stories and lots of commentaries collecting a big, heavy book. We wouldn't have anything. So though nothing can be done about Manjushri's leaking, maybe not really criticism, maybe really praise. He leaked, but he leaked for us. He said the Buddha is thus for us. And then I just, you know, saw this in the commentary, talking about this creation weaving her lumen shuttle, which literally the word creation here is the mother principle, or the mother of evolution runs her loom and shuttle. And the commentary says, Confucianism and Taoism are based on one energy. It's like the source energy that's the creating the universe, we might say. The Buddhist tradition, so these in China, the three big traditions, Confucianism, Taoism, and Buddhism. So Buddhist tradition is based on one mind. Taoism and Confucianism based on one energy, Buddhism based on one mind. Guifeng, one Zen teacher, said that this original energy, this one energy of Buddhism and Taoism, still is created by mind. He said actually what they call the one energy is really one mind, and it's all contained in the storehouse consciousness, which we've heard about some, this alaya vijnana, that the actually that one energy that creates all of evolution and nature is all actually in the storehouse consciousness. I, Wang Song, the collector of this book, say this is the very source of the Soto school, the lifeline of the Buddhas and ancestors. So I just particularly appreciated that, because we talk about alaya vijnana and the storehouse consciousness, which is associated with this yogacara or mind-only school of Buddhism. We may think, well, what's this got to do with Soto Zen? That's this strange old Indian philosophical tradition. So to say that everything that called the one energy is all contained in this repository storehouse consciousness, this commentator says that this is the very source of the Soto school. So it's very close to our teaching, the one mind from which everything arises. So that's the first story in the Book of Serenity. The second is the case at hand, the one that the head student will bring up next week, called Bodhidharma's Emptiness.
So now we're about 1,000 years later.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. So the Buddha was 500 BC, right? And Bodhidharma is around 500 CE or AD. And so yeah, about 1,000 years later, we've jumped from the first story to the second. And then most of the stories are then about the Chinese Zen ancestors. But this Book of Serenity starts with the story about the Buddha. Just sitting on the seat, it's pointed out that his just sitting there is thus, and he disappears. That's kind of like setting the stage for the rest of these stories. And pointing to what words do, right? To say the Dharma of the Dharma King is thus. To say those words for Manjushri Bodhisattva to say those words is already too much. So then there's all these stories that are in words. So it's a little reminder at the beginning that all of these words are cannot be grasped as what's really happening. And this story is quite similar. It's just Bodhidharma's way of expressing the same thing with a little bit of words. Like the Buddha didn't use any words in the last story. Now Bodhidharma's going to say a little, but not very much. He was not a talkative guy, it looks like. So Bodhidharma is this legendary, mysterious character who sailed all the way from India around the south over to the east coast of China, and landed there. I think his teacher sent him to China, said, bring Zen to China, please. Buddhism was already flourishing in China, actually. But Bodhidharma's separate transmission outside the scriptures was not yet born in China. So somehow Bodhidharma made it to the emperor's place, maybe the palace. We don't know exactly how he got there. But Emperor Wu of Liang, of the Liang dynasty, asked great teacher Bodhidharma, what is the highest meaning of the holy truths? It's the Zen question that's often asked. right, go straight to the heart of the matter. Now, Emperor Wu was actually a devout Buddhist practitioner, and he actually taught sutras and so on, according to history. So he knew what the sutras said about the highest meaning of the holy truths, but he wanted to get Bodhidharma's take on this. Now, this could be the four holy truths, the four noble truths of Buddhism. It could be the two truths. The Blue Cliff Record commentary seems to imply that actually he's talking about the two truths of the conventional appearances of things and the ultimate non-abiding reality of things. Or just the ultimate, what is the highest meaning of the holy truth, the one truth of Buddha Dharma. Doesn't matter so much which ones in this case, because Bodhidharma simply said, empty, there's no holy, or vast emptiness, no holiness. What's the highest meaning of the holy truths? That they're not holy. And vast emptiness. What's the highest meaning of the holy truths? Vast emptiness. Nothing holy. And the emperor had seen these Mahayana sutras about emptiness before, seems, but maybe he wasn't used to getting such an answer so quickly and so straightforwardly, and with no further explanation, Bodhidharma just saying that and standing there. So the emperor said, maybe suspiciously, "Who are you facing me? Who is this? Who just said that?" Bodhidharma said, "Don't know." The emperor did not understand. Bodhidharma subsequently crossed the Yangtze River, came to Shaolin, and faced a wall for 9 years. Now, the Blue Cliff Record version says something like he crossed the Yangtze River and came to the kingdom of Wei and had another little discussion with the minister there, who asked him, "Do you know who that was?" Oh no, Bodhidharma went to the kingdom of Wei, where he sat facing the wall. It doesn't mention facing the wall for 9 years in that version, because the Soto Zen version, that's the best part of the story. Bodhidharma just sat for 9 years facing the wall. But in the Blue Cliff Record, Bodhidharma went to the kingdom of Wei. Meanwhile, the emperor's minister, Jur, said, "Do you know who that was, Your Majesty?" And he said, "I don't know. I don't know." And the minister said, "That was the Mahasattva Avalokiteshvara, expressing the Buddha mind seal, the Bodhisattva of great compassion, totally expressing everything." And the emperor was regretful that he let him go without asking him further, and he said, "Can you call him back?" Mm-hmm. And the minister juror said, "Your Majesty, even if everyone in all of China were to try to call him back, he still would not return." That whole section is not in this version. What's the highest meaning of the holy truths? Vast emptiness, no holy. Who are you facing me? I don't know. And, it's almost always translated as "don't know." It's so straightforward. But the character is actually maybe more common reading, if out of context, would be for "don't know" would be "not consciousness." it's not actually the usual word for knowing, but it's the usual character for vijnana or consciousness. So we could quite literally translate it as, who are you facing me? Not consciousness. This is not consciousness here. That would be another way to say it. So when Bodhidharma said, don't know, the emperor didn't understand, Bodhidharma didn't say, well, let me explain more. Let me sit down for a minute, like have a cup of tea, and because this is going to take a while. He just, I don't know who this is. And the emperor was like, huh? And Bodhidharma just turned and started walking across the river, found this cave up above Shaolin Monastery, and sat facing the wall of this cave for 9 years. And this, that little piece of the story is the origin, as we understand it, of our Zen tradition of sitting facing the wall during meditation. In this school of Zen, we, it's kind of like unusual, I think, when people first come in, they would think, wouldn't the intuitive thing, we're sitting in a circle around the room, shouldn't we sit facing the center? But we actually sit facing the wall. To celebrate Bodhidharma's wall gazing in his cave for 9 years. Bodhidharma is our great hero. One Zen teacher's verse celebrating this the story of Bodhidharma says, willing to endure the autumn frost so the deep savor of the teaching will last, even though caught alive, after all, he is not lavishly praised. The autumn frost of this very kind of cool style, some might say kind of cold style, to just let the emperor stand there dumbfounded and walk away and face the wall. And then sit there and endure the autumn frost and the spring flowers and the autumn frost and the spring flowers and the autumn frost and the spring flowers and the autumn frost and the spring flowers. And the spring flowers. 9 times enduring the change of seasons in his silent mystery cave, so that the deep savor of the teaching will last. It's a beautiful and kind of heart-wrenching poem. Willing to endure the autumn frost so the deep savor of the teaching will last. Maybe that's a little poetic phrase of inspiration for our 7 days of sitting. Enduring this, the autumn leaves falling and swirling around, enduring all the stuff that's going on in the world without doing anything about it for 7 days, so that the deep savor of the teaching will last. That's Bodhidharma style. He just sat there for 9 years. And luckily, someone found him up in that cave. I mean, maybe a lot of people try to get him to say something more than don't know. But I think he really was not a talkative guy. But one person managed, with quite a bit of struggle, as we know the story, to get him to teach him a little bit more. And that was the second Chinese ancestor. And if not for him, and not for Bodhidharma's compassion to instruct this person a little bit more, we wouldn't have Zen today. It all derives from those silent types up in the frosty cave, so that the teaching will last up to today. So the verse is, willing to endure the autumn frost so the deep savor of the teaching will last, even though caught alive, after all, he is not lavishly praised. I think this is about the emperor caught him alive. The emperor caught him right in front of him, and Bodhidharma was completely alive, which is why he could say, I don't even know who I am. After all, he's not lavishly praised by the emperor. Just as like, what kind of a joke is that? He doesn't even know who he is. Worthless. And even in Bodhidharma's lifetime, I think he was not lavishly praised. He just was way up there on the mountaintop. Later, Emperor Wu, after he was gone, and after Bodhidharma died and had become known by that point, the emperor wrote an epitaph for Bodhidharma, which said, I saw him without seeing. I met him without meeting him. Now, as of old, I regret and lament this. He was right there before him, Bodhidharma. He saw him, but he didn't really see him. And he met him, but he didn't really meet him. And he regretted it. So now the verse that the collector of the stories writes to celebrate Bodhidharma's story. And this is the verse that traditionally the Benji, who's another role of the Shuso's assistant in the ceremony, traditionally recites this verse. And nowadays in America, the Benji often writes their own poem. But this is the celebrating the story. Qian Tong's verse. Empty, nothing holy, the approach is far off. Succeeding, he swings the axe without injuring the nose. Failing, he drops the pitcher without looking back. So I'll stop and mention these images a little bit. So as is often the case with these verses are like very literary allusions and celebrations to all kinds of stories in ancient China. So this is a Taoist story from Chuangzi. And this story is told that as Ying Ren was plastering a wall, he must have been a contractor. He was plastering a wall, and he splashed a bit on his nose, a spot as big as a fly wing. So plastering a wall, a little like spot of plaster on his nose as big as a fly wing. He had Jiangshi cut it off. Jiangshi was a master axeman. So he cut the plaster off with an axe. And he swung the axe, creating a breeze, and cut it off with a whoosh. Closing his eyes, letting his hand swing freely, he cut away the whole spot without injuring Ying Ren's nose. Ying Ren stood there without flinching. And then this teacher says, since the death of these people, I have no one capable of being my disciples. How to swing an axe with your eyes closed to cut a piece of plaster the size of a fly wing off someone's nose. That is a very skillful, attentive, and trusting. And the one whose nose is sticking out didn't flinch. So they were both quite trusting. So the verse here, referring to the story, says, succeeding, he swings the axe without injuring the nose. So, referring to Bodhidharma's immediately, with his eyes closed, responding by saying, vast emptiness, nothing holy, I don't know. He cut off every bit of plaster off Emperor Wu's nose, and he didn't damage the nose at all. Now, Emperor Wu didn't seem to appreciate that that little bit of plaster was gone. But celebrating Bodhidharma, from Bodhidharma's perspective, he succeeded swinging the axe without injuring the nose very skillfully and with nothing, no extra calculation, right? This is the spirit of answering, don't know. Just swing it. Succeeding, he swings the axe without injuring the nose. Failing, he drops the pitcher without looking back. So this again refers to this Chinese story of the Zen teacher who once was carrying a pitcher and it fell to the ground, but he went on without looking back. Another monk saw this and asked him the meaning, and the teacher replied, "The pitcher's already broken. What's the use of looking back?" So this is also like Bodhidharma. It says, failing, he drops the pitcher without looking back. He failed to awaken the emperor, but the conversation was now broken. He, nothing else could happen, and he just left. He didn't try to fix it up. He didn't try to patch up the situation and explain further. He just went and sat. And I think this is a wonderful image, dropping the pitcher without looking back. And a great, actually, practice instruction for daily life and for practice of sesshin, to just keep doing each thing as it arises and not get caught up in judging ourselves for something that just happened and making a mistake. We have all these forms, right, all these Zen forms, and it's in sesshin we have more because we have things like orioki, and it's easy to get caught up in the getting the forms just right and then feeling like, oh, I messed up, and then we start dwelling on messing up. So we might drop the pitcher many times. We might drop our food bowls and our chopsticks on the floor. But the greatest practice is to just not look back. Just go on to the next thing. No regrets. That's what happened. The pitcher dropped. The chopsticks fell. Just ask the head server to come pick them up, purify them and return them without, and then it's maybe easy to go on the rest of the meal. Oh, I wish I hadn't done that. I kind of like messed it. I put them to all that trouble, having to pick up my chopsticks. No, it's just, it's all the dance. Everything's the dance. Oh, I missed that bell in when we're doing service, ringing the bells. I did an extra bell, or I missed the bell, or the timing was off. All the infinite little things we can do, we might feel like our mistakes, but actually aren't really mistakes. They're just part of the course of events, and to just let that happen and not look back. No regrets. I could say like that we'll just sit for 7 days of no regrets. When I read this today, I thought of the story of Sodom and Gomorrah. It's an, I don't know all the aspects of this metaphor, but it looked like God wanted to destroy this city of Gomorrah, and he let it was a totally corrupt place. But there was this one guy, Lot, right? Mr. Lot seemed to be the only good person in the whole town. So God said to him, or maybe the angels told him something like, we'll spare your life. You just get out as quick as you can. Get out and don't look back. Like the world is falling apart behind you, and it's time now for you to actually go to your mountain cave and face the wall for 9 years, and things are going to fall apart behind you, but like, it's done. You have to carry on, do your work. Don't think about the past anymore. Don't look back. And apparently he could do that, but his family was with him, and his wife couldn't quite bear to not look back. So she turned back, saw the city blazing, and immediately was turned into salt, a pillar of salt, because she looked behind. So the... And then today, I had an experience with this. Shoho was had prepared this very kindly, had prepared this breakfast for us, and was going to bring it upstairs where I was, and I could hear her. We had all these oranges, and she was squeezing all these oranges, making fresh squeezed orange juice, and it took a while. And I heard the orange juice squeezer stop, and finally the footsteps were coming, and here comes breakfast. And then I heard the torrential crash. The pitcher of juice, the plate of toast, the tray, everything on it crashed to the floor and spewed everywhere. There was and then I was waiting for like a kind of like some kind of curse or something, but it was like silent. It's like, did it kill her? What happened? So I went down, and luckily it missed the carpeted part. But the entire wooden floor was like a sea of orange juice, and like a jar of tahini had spread over the whole floor, all mixed together. And I was amazed at the mess, but I was even more amazed that she was just like cleaning it up, and she even kind of looked up and smiled. And it was already like, you know, it was going to be a stressful day already, and like then this happened. And so I was kind of in awe. I'm like, I can't believe it. Like, you don't seem to be so upset. And she's like, well, maybe this is the fruits of practice. And just, there's nothing to do. It's what happened. And she said, it would have been better if I had just dropped it and kept walking without looking back. And I said, that's the story I'm going to talk about tonight. I said, still, it was pretty good. I'm impressed. And like, how great this is. And then, as we were cleaning up, I started, oh man, all that orange juice. Like, I started thinking, I was regretting it, right? Like, but our breakfast, we're going to have to like cook it all again. And then I remembered this story. And I kind of caught myself, and like, just don't go there. It's so easy to go there, but just don't go there. Just don't look back. I think it's like the regret thing is we just wish it had happened another way. And I think in the course of a meditation retreat, there may be many moments like this. I regret coming this morning at 3 o'clock in the afternoon after being here since 4:30 in the morning. I didn't need to come. I didn't need to do this with my precious day. But that's a dark path to go down that doesn't lead anywhere, as we know. Just the next thing. those plates are gone, that pitcher's gone, that juice is gone, that tahini's gone. Let's cook another breakfast. Very hard, I think, to not look back. And I think if I was Bodhidharma in this story and the emperor looked perplexed, I don't know if I could have bared to endure the autumn frost and turn around and walk up that mountain and just demonstrate that there's nothing to be said here and there's nothing to be done ultimately. Empty, nothing holy, the approach is far off. Succeeding, he swings the axe without injuring the nose. Failing, he drops the pitcher without looking back. Still and silent, coolly he sat at Shaolin. In silence, he completely brought up the true imperative. The clear moon of autumn turns its frosty disk. The Milky Way thin. The dipper hangs down its handle in the night. In succession, the robe and bowl have been imparted to descendants. From this, humans and divinities have made medicine and disease. Are these teachings medicine to cure our painful delusions, or do we get too into trying to figure it out and feel like we're not going to get it and be suffering more than before we even heard about Zen? Anything can be made into medicine or disease. So I don't know what kind of questions we'll have about next week, but you're welcome to ask about Bodhidharma. Ask the Shuso about Bodhidharma's nothing holy and not knowing and facing the wall. Any crucial points? Yes.
You just got me thinking about something breaking or falling. Like this morning, I had something similar happen to me today. But for me, it's sort of easy to say, okay, that happened. There's no way to go back to getting one's shoes or the broken glass. But when it involves someone,
yes,
where you have the options, and can I go back and make amends? That's a much different challenge to say, move on.
Yes, yeah. If it's a matter of making amends, but maybe we could see this story in the light of two Dharma practitioners just trying to bring out the Dharma. In this case, it was just a matter of clarifying Dharma. It wasn't really that either one insulted the other, and Bodhidharma's way of moving on in this case was just to demonstrate that that Dharma principle of not even thus. But I think it's true that in human relations that aren't just a matter of bringing out the highest meaning of the holy truth, then often we go back and make amends, but in that spirit, still, I think it's possible in that spirit of, and I think this is a big challenge in our practice, how far to go with trying to fix things. And I would say especially in sesshin, because things happen. Well, you know, in 7 days with, I think there's like 18 people coming in and out of this sesshin, this retreat, things come up because people are like, sitting for so long, things will come up, conflicts, maybe a lot of the conflicts never get to the verbal stage, they're just internal, but sometimes they come out, and that's, I think, a big challenge in sesshin is how far to go with making amends. Like we can, I think I tend to err on the maybe too much side. Last sesshin, I like stayed up late one night trying to work it out with somebody in a verbal way, and I wonder about that. sometimes it may be the best thing to say, we try it a little bit, and then let's go back and sit together now. If both people can do that, I think we can have that kind of spirit. The sitting holds us, particularly, you know, in a retreat. So some of us will not meet again for another week. Some of us will meet in the silent stillness, the frosty moon turning its autumn disc, the dipper hanging down its handle in the night. We dedicate that any non-merit arising from this discussion tonight to our great ancestor Bodhidharma, demonstrating the true imperative, willing to endure the autumn frost so that the savor of the Dharma will remain. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable, I vow to become it.